Welcome to episode 112 of Frank Reactions, the podcast where we help you profit from the digital era through better customer experiences online and off. My name is Tema Frank. If you're old enough to remember KTEL, you've heard the booming call now command, usually aired a lot louder than the program that it was interrupting. Personally, I always hated it, but it must have been effective because I think they still do that on late night TV, although I'm never up late enough to watch. Or if I am up that late, I'm doing something a lot more interesting than watching the Shopping Channel. Today's interview with University of Alberta marketing professor Sarah Moore explores when that kind of command can work in marketing and when it definitely doesn't. Turns out it has a lot to do with the nature of your relationship with the brand. And from what her research found, I suspect that a lot of companies are actually hurting themselves by telling you what to do when they really shouldn't be. You'd think that in our data-driven world, businesses wouldn't still just be copying what others do without checking to see if it works for their customers. But hey, we're probably all guilty of having taken that shortcut at least once in our marketing. So if you don't have the resources to do a lot of testing and data analysis, or the time, this interview will at least give you some useful guidelines about how to talk to your customers. Before we get started, just a quick heads up about two upcoming events I'll be speaking at in Edmonton, Alberta in the next few weeks. On November 1st, I'll be presenting at Disrupt HR. And I gotta say, preparing that talk was one of the hardest talks I've ever had to prepare because you only get 5 minutes, you have to have 20 slides, and they auto-advance every 15 seconds. So you've gotta be bang on with your timing. You can get tickets to that at disrupthryeg.eventbrite.ca. And then on November 22nd, I'll be one of three authors speaking at the Financial Management Institute of Canada, or FMI's, Edmonton chapter at an event called Disruptive Writing. The other authors who've been confirmed are Rod Schatz, who's the author of Phantom Ex Machina, Digital Disruption's Role in Business Model Transformation, and Rob Roach, author of Spiders in Space, I love that title, Successfully Adapting to Unwanted Change. You can learn more and get tickets for that event at bit.ly/FMI Disrupt. Hope to see you at one of or both of those events, and in the meantime, enjoy the interview. I'm Sarah Moore. I'm an associate professor at the University of Alberta at the Business School in the marketing department. I specialized in marketing and within marketing, consumer behavior. So I'm basically a consumer psychologist.
Right.
It's like social psychology meets the marketplace.
Right.
So,
which is where the fun stuff is.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I came across your research when you had written an article, or I guess were quoted in an article, about one of my pet peeves, which is, you know, you see it more and more on websites where they say, do this now, or the one that really drives me crazy, which is they give you a choice of, yes, sign me up, or no, I don't want to be smarter. You know?
So it's not really a choice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell me a bit about what that research was all about.
Well, so we originally came at it from kind of a theory perspective because my advisor, who is my co-author on the paper, and one of the women that I did my PhD with, she's also a co-author on the paper, we were interested in what's called reactance motivation, which is basically that knee-jerk reaction that you have anytime anybody tells you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's so my little sister, when she was younger, used to say all the time, you're not the boss of me,
uh-huh,
anytime you told her what to do. So
yep.
That, in a nutshell, is reactance motivation.
Right.
So we'd been studying that in some other contexts and got interested in, why are there so many of these ads that tell people what to do all the time? And actually, I think since we started the project, they've become even more common.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some imperative phrases, that is, phrases that are commands that tell you what to do, that I think have just become
part of the advertising vernacular. So like us on Facebook,
yeah,
or follow us on Twitter. Those are commands that you're not asking people, mm-hmm, you know, like, come and visit our website, we'd like to see you.
Yeah.
You're telling them to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were interested in, why are there so many of these ads? Because there are a lot of them. We did a content analysis of, these are magazine print ads, and this, mm-hmm, was a few years ago. And there were almost two in every ad.
Wow.
And many of them are, visit our website, call us for more information. But some of them are the really blatant, buy now, call today, you'll regret it if you don't, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So we really wanted to figure out why there are so many of these, because there's lots of academic research that says that because of reactance motivation, all you really should do is piss people off,
mm-hmm,
when you're giving them these kinds of commands. And one of the things that nobody had ever looked at in the reactance literature is how we respond, or how reactance motivation changes depending on who is telling us what to do. And so you can imagine in human relationships,
mm-hmm,
the parents telling kids what to do is very different than your spouse telling you what to do.
Although they both probably get a negative reaction.
Then you're probably very high on reactance motivation, which is an individual difference measure as well.
Okay.
So there's been a kind of growing literature in marketing that looks at brand relationships, kind of human brand relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take lots and lots of stuff about human relationships and kind of use it as an analogy to understand how humans relate to brands.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really surprising that we have relationships with brands, or we feel like we do, because we anthropomorphize all kinds of things. We do,
yes,
it with animals, and so, yeah, of course we do it with brands.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can take lots of kind of big principles of human relationships, and one of them is your relationship a long-term committed relationship? Or is it this kind of short-term fling where there's no loyalty, you don't really care, you have no obligations to them, you don't feel like you owe them anything, and they don't owe you anything?
Right.
Or the other end of the spectrum, you're basically married to the brand, you feel you've been loyal for years, you've built up this trust and obligation, so you feel like you need to support them,
mm-hmm,
and in return that they will treat you as a respected partner.
Right. Okay.
And so we kind of put those two things together and said, ironically, what happens when you get a committed consumer, someone who feels like they're in this important relationship with the brand, when that brand tells them what to do, they get really upset. And this, I think, is actually an interesting difference between human and brand relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So if your spouse tells you what to do, even if you really don't want to do it, you know there will be consequences if you don't.
Right.
You're going to feel guilty. And so more often than not, you'll probably do it.
Mm-hmm.
You'll comply with whatever they've told you to do.
Mm-hmm.
In brand relationships, that guilt trip backfires.
Hmm.
Because at the end of the day, it's a brand,
mm-hmm,
and not a person. And so when the brand tries to use something like a guilt trip, buy now, and I know you're going to do it because you're committed and because I know you like me,
mm-hmm,
then it backfires. Because that makes consumers think, wait a minute, why are you trying to guilt trip me? Why do you think you can get away with this? And then you start to think that it's a persuasion tactic and you get upset.
Hmm.
Because that's a violation of your relationship. The brand shouldn't be doing that.
Right.
You're already loyal.
You should choose
to
like it. You should choose to, yeah.
Yeah, so they're kind of violating those expectations you have of this committed relationship and how they're going to treat you.
Yeah.
Because they're not recognizing that in your past behavior or whatever it happens to be, which is why committed people get very upset. And those, of course, are not the people that you want upset at you.
Right. Now, is it, I mean, when I think about it and where I see it most, though, is typically in those short-term relationships or when they're trying to start a relationship with a customer and they're saying, you know, buy now or
and
seize this order before it's gone.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. I think there are lots of, actually, tons of interesting directions to go. So we're looking at people in our studies who, we usually asked people in the studies to identify a brand for us that,
mm-hmm,
they either had this kind of short-term fling relationship with or they were in this long-term relationship. So those are pre-existing relationships.
Okay.
So I think there's lots of interesting things about where the relationship is. And I think for starting a relationship, commands probably work really well, especially if, so there's kind of two different versions of commands that you see in ads. most of them, which are the ones that we looked at, are these kind of open-ended, like, buy now, call today, mm-hmm. with no kind of concrete consequence or threat okay. if you don't.
Right.
So the only consequence is this implied guilt. And only people who are in committed relationships perceive that when you say buy now. But you can also say there's a whole other category of ads, which are much smaller mm-hmm. in the magazine sample, but things like buy now, sale ends tomorrow.
Right.
So if you don't buy today, you're not going to get that discount.
Right.
And so if I'm not in a relationship with you, that might be a great way to push me into the relationship. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of an interesting, I think looking at the long-term implications of starting a brand relationship that way would be interesting. So if you're basically forced into buying a brand for the first time, mm-hmm. If you feel like you did it only because you wanted to get the discount or they were offering you a deal you couldn't refuse, does that change the way you perceive the relationship than if you had just decided you were going to buy it because somebody else told you it was a great brand or because you'd done some research online and found out about them? Mm-hmm. So I think that's a whole other interesting research question.
There are so many research questions.
Yes. There's another kind of general rule of thumb that you can think of for kind of what kinds of brands can get away with this. So you can think of brand relationships kind of at the individual level, and companies, I think, are getting more and more data now, and so are going to be better able to tell kind of who looks like a committed consumer versus mm-hmm. who looks like they're in the short term, like they buy from us a few times a year or once every 5 years. But you can also think of brands as having certain personalities, which they work very hard to establish.
Yes.
And there are certain kinds of brand personalities with which consumers, on average, develop certain kinds of relationships.
Okay.
So sincere brands like Coca-Cola, like Hallmark, like Campbell's Soup, like Procter & Gamble and Johnson are down to earth. They have this kind of nostalgic, old-fashioned kind of feel. Those are the kinds of brands that we tend to form committed relationships with.
Okay.
Exciting brands like Virgin, Jones Soda, Mountain Dew, all these energy drink kind of companies like Red Bull. Mm-hmm. Those are the brands that we tend to form these short-term, more fling-like relationships with. And if those okay. kinds of brands use imperative advertising, nobody cares. It doesn't bother anybody. But it also doesn't actually get them to do anything.
Right.
So it's kind of neutral. You can do it, and it might push a couple of people on the margin,
yeah.
but it doesn't seem to have a fairly large effect on average. Whereas if you're using if you're a sincere brand and you're using this imperative advertising, on average, you're probably going to make people mad. So some brands can get away with it. It just doesn't seem to be very beneficial.
So what about the way the imperative ads are phrased? So if instead of saying like us on Facebook, you're saying please like us on Facebook, does that make a difference?
So we actually tried a study where we said please.
Yeah.
Because we were like, there must be some way to make an imperative more polite. And yeah. there's lots of stuff in the linguistics literature that says you should be able to do this. Mm-hmm. So we tried a please, mm-hmm. and it didn't work. So committed people were still upset even if you said please, because I think the principle hasn't changed.
Okay.
Even if you say please, you're clearly still trying to guilt trip me, and that's still not okay. Mm-hmm. But we also tried an ad phrasing where we made it less direct.
Okay.
So I think if you phrase it so that it's not directly towards the person, mm-hmm. so please buy now, like us on Facebook, we said, instead, now is a good time to buy. So we didn't say, mm-hmm. you really need to come in and buy now. We said, right. you know, kind of in general, we think it's a great time to buy our product, and that worked.
Right.
So people weren't upset.
Because if they've got the relationship, they trust your advice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you phrase it kind of so it's both less individual and less of an imperative, then you can get people to buy in. And I think a lot of that is because people in committed relationships are willing to take your word for it. Right. If you phrase it in a way that recognizes their relationship instead of trying to take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. What about, I mean, we talked about, you know, buy now because the sale's about to end. What about other appeals to their desire to support you? So you're saying, you know, if we get more likes on Facebook, you can help us get more likes on Facebook, and that's going to help us do X. Yeah, what impact does that have?
I think we haven't tested that directly. We talked about doing it in order to turn the effect off.
Yeah.
And I think it would probably work. So because phrasing it in that way makes the consumer a valued part of that right. brand relationship.
Right.
So we're asking you to do something because we value you as a customer. And mm-hmm. we know that you can help us do it. And so, of course, you're going to help do mm-hmm. it. So I think that also would work, yes. As long as it's clear, as long as the motivation is clear. So if people can't yes. kind of misconstrue it as, well, you're asking me to do this, but clearly you're just doing it because you want to make an extra $1 million on your bottom line this year. So I think as long as that part was clear, then it would work.
Okay. So the other thing that, and I don't know if you've looked at this, but the other thing that drives me crazy, because I live a lot in the internet marketing world and have seen a lot of this stuff. And one of the things that drives me crazy is when they set up artificial deadlines or, you know, this webinar is no longer going to be available or this product's no, and you know,
it's, and then miraculously we extended the deadline.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what kind of reactions does that get?
I think there's kind of two aspects of that. I think if you're already in a brand relationship, you're going to be upset to begin with. And then you're going to be even more upset if that turns out not to be true.
Mm-hmm.
There's a furniture store along Calgary Trail that was going out of business tomorrow for like 9 months. And then all of a sudden they were back. All of the signs were gone. They were still there.
Oh, no.
So I'm never going to go shopping there.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the other things that people, and we didn't look at this, but over time, I think consumers learn, of course. And mm-hmm. as they learn kind of your advertising techniques, they're changing their perceptions of your brand and their relationship with your brand. And they're deciding whether they're going to believe you next time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think crying wolf probably doesn't work. But in order for consumers to recognize that, they have to be paying attention, which sometimes they are and sometimes they're not.
Well, and even not necessarily learning directly from how that brand is. But as I said, I see so much of that type of advertising that I'm very sensitive to it.
Yeah.
Whereas so, if I were a newbie, I might actually believe that maybe this yeah. really is a one-time thing.
Yeah. And I think people certainly generalize kind of across brands. And that's one of the, I think the reason ultimately that the brand relationship guilt trip doesn't work is because of what we call persuasion knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's this kind of general body that you learn over time as mm-hmm. you interact in the marketplace with different companies, as you see different ads, you learn something about different persuasion tactics.
Right.
And so when people in committed relationships recognize that a brand is using a very specific persuasion tactic on them,
mm-hmm.
that's a violation of the relationship. And
right.
so as consumers, even if we're not in committed relationships with brands, I think we often don't appreciate the use of blatant
yeah.
persuasion tactics or things that, even if it's not that blatant, things that we interpret as a clear attempt to make us do something or mm-hmm. buy something or change our minds. And so I think if consumers perceive it in that way, then they're almost guaranteed to respond negatively and so, become immune, right?
Right.
We just start ignoring all of these things that say buy now and sign up now. And
yeah. Yeah. And I mean, when I think the earlier days of Facebook pages, people were very open to liking a page on Facebook, whereas
yeah.
now it's why?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why would I do this?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, what about, let's talk a little bit more about the non-committed relationships and strengthening those to develop committed relationships or even to get into a relationship in the first place. How do those imperative commands work there? And in what circumstances would they make sense or not make sense?
Consumers in uncommitted relationships are kind of interesting. and we spent a lot of time trying to push them around too.
Yeah.
And they didn't ever do much. And I think that's because when you're in this kind of casual, I buy from you when I want, but I don't have to, I don't really feel any loyalty, that there's really no rules in the relationship in the same way as there are for a committed relationship. And so in some ways that's good for consumers and marketers because, as we found out, marketers can say kind of whatever they want and consumers don't really care. They're still going to buy from you or not as they choose.
Okay.
And so there is some nice freedom there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to kind of convert people, and it's certainly true that when we talked about kind of sincere brands versus exciting brands and consumers on average having a certain type of relationship with these two brands, but there's always going to be variation. So mm-hmm. some consumers probably have very committed relationships with Jones Soda or mm-hmm. with Red Bull, mm-hmm. even though it's an exciting brand. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, you would expect to see the same kinds of responses from those consumers. Mm-hmm. I think if you want to get people to transition into more committed relationships, you can think about, and this is where kind of the analogy between human relationships comes in handy, but you also go beyond it because brand relationships at the end of the day are different. Mm-hmm. So when we get to know other human people and develop relationships with them, one of the key predictors of relationship closeness is intimacy mm-hmm. and disclosure. So how much we know about the other person. Mm-hmm. And brands can engineer these kinds of things fairly easily, especially now. You can ask consumers all kinds of things. So I signed up, this was a while ago now, for Banana Republic's email list. Mm-hmm. And they ask you when you sign up what clothing products you're particularly interested in. Mm-hmm. That's disclosure. They're clearly interested in getting to know me
yeah.
and in customizing what they're offering to me. And so that's a great way to start down that pathway to a committed relationship. Because
yes.
the brand is signaling, I want to get to know you and you particularly.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to take that information and use it in a way that's useful to you. So I'm
at least you hope they are.
Yes. yes. So I'm offering you something more
right.
that you can then reciprocate. So there's this kind of back and forth mm-hmm. of information and disclosure mm-hmm. and this kind of eventual, and the critical part of committed relationships is this idea of dependence or obligation, that when we're in this committed relationship, I, as a consumer, have rules about how I'm going to behave, mm-hmm. that I will buy from you before I buy from other people, and I will do that on purpose, even if it costs more or even if it's harder for me. Mm-hmm. And I expect that you as a brand will do the same thing, mm-hmm. that you too will offer me special discounts or go out of your way to help me when I need it. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of things can come through fairly easily online yeah. or in customer service or other things that, and all of those little pieces, mm-hmm. I think, can start to tip the relationship from this kind of casual, we don't really care, we don't have any obligations, to wait a minute, they know more about me mm-hmm. and they're more interested in me and I feel like I'm getting to know them at the same time.
Right.
So I think there's little signals that are getting easier to send than they used to be because right. we have all this data and all of these easy ways to communicate with consumers and to make things one-on-one.
Well, that's the thing that strikes me too with your general conclusion about committed relationships versus non, is it means that market segmentation becomes so much more important because you want to send very different messaging to those who are already loyal
yep,
versus
exactly.
those who aren't.
Yeah, and you need to be able to tell. And there are some, I mean, there's a fine line between, so you might have years of data and you might find a consumer who has been buying from you for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And they probably look like a committed consumer. They might be, but they might not be mm-hmm. because they might have a very practical reason from buying from you for all those years. You're
sure.
the cheapest or
yeah.
you're the only one available in their hometown or whatever it happens
of course.
To be.
Yeah.
And so it can be hard to tell. Just from looking at data.
Yeah.
But it's pretty easy to ask people, actually.
Right.
And so there are fairly easy ways to measure what kind of relationship I think I have with you. And sometimes that's probably the easiest way to do it, is just to ask, what do you think our relationship looks like? And we'd like to make it better. And I think consumers, especially ones in committed relationships, would be pretty happy to answer that question. And to say, here's what I think our relationship looks like. And then you can take that and go from there.
And then there's this early stage. I'm wondering, too, looking at the analogy, do you go through a honeymoon phase? Like, how does that translate?
Well, there's a very classic paper in marketing that came out in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of when the whole human relationship analogy started.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that the woman's name is Susan Fournier. She's at Boston University. And one of the things she has in that article is a whole bunch of different relationship timelines with brands. And a lot of them look fairly similar to what you might predict for human relationships. So some of them are like fads, mm-hmm. actual flings. Yes. So you're obsessed with a particular flavor of chips for yes. 2 weeks. Yeah. You eat them all the time and then you're sick of them and you never want to eat them again.
Right.
Or you binge watch TV.
Yeah.
That same kind of like intense while it's happening. You're right. obsessed with it. You love it. And then you're done.
Yeah.
And then there are these kind of cyclical back and forth, like I cycle between chamomile tea and mint tea, and I just kind of go back and forth. I like them both, but my behavior kind of ebbs and flows towards one or the other. So there are lots, and then the committed relationships kind of start at the bottom and then have this clear development phase where they increase in kind of intensity and intimacy and trust, mm-hmm. and then they level off, and mm-hmm. they kind of stay that way, assuming that you don't do anything to screw it up.
Right.
And then if you screw it up, there is a paper that has looked at kind of long-term customer service failures in relationships with exciting brands versus sincere brands.
Oh,
so
yeah.
exciting brands can get away with it, not surprisingly.
Okay.
We forgive them
right.
for these transgressions because we didn't expect them. We didn't have such high expectations to begin with.
Hmm.
Sincere brands, if they screw up, we're much less likely to forgive them. Hmm. And in order to get us to forgive them, they didn't do this in the paper. But I think it's like your spouse having to work triple and overtime to actually get the brand would have to not quite grovel, but really, really make amends. Because
right.
once that trust, especially in a brand relationship, because we have all this corporate persuasion knowledge going on,
mm-hmm.
once that trust is broken,
yeah.
once you've violated those relationship norms, it's really hard to get that back.
Yeah. Yeah, I've looked at in one of my presentations, I am talking about brand promises and
mm-hmm.
I give the example, okay, you see the Volvo logo, you associate safety,
mm-hmm.
you see Ferrari, you associate power, speed, and then you see Volkswagen. And it's no longer clear because
yeah.
they violated the trust. And if
yep.
you look at their stock market performance, they're not even close to regaining
yeah.
what they were before that violation.
Yeah, exactly. And that one was big.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So that's about as severe as you can get. But yeah, I think there hasn't been a lot of work that looks at, because it's hard to do, getting easier, but that looks at kind of relationship development and change over time
mm-hmm.
and how committed brands actually can recover, I think is a really interesting question. So what do you do? And you could start again, with the human relationships, what is it that a relationship partner has to do
mm-hmm.
once they have transgressed in some way to get your forgiveness? And who
right.
are we more likely to forgive? And when you add persuasion knowledge to that, what happens?
Okay, so I just had this mental flash of abusive relationships.
Well, there are actually, so in that original brand relationships article, she talks about negative brand relationships,
huh.
which I guess is kind of the analogy.
Yeah.
And there are some brand relationships, of course, that we hate, but we can't get out of because
like our cable TV.
Exactly.
Or, yeah.
They're the only service provider
right.
or we're locked into a contract.
Yeah.
And so we end up in these horrible negative cycles where we hate them and
yeah.
it just gets worse and worse and worse, but we can't do anything about it.
Right.
And I think those are, from an academic perspective, fascinating relationships to look at. Does it matter that consumers hate you? Maybe once every 5 years when the contract comes up.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think there's lots of interesting
or
questions.
Or until there's
too.
A disruptor.
Yeah, exactly.
Witness taxis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, how many people like their taxi services and then Uber hits and
yeah.
people fight to
yeah.
get the right to access Uber, even if we're not so thrilled with some of their leadership.
Exactly.
One of my pet peeves in marketing is when we talk about customer loyalty using things like loyalty cards, which isn't loyalty in
no.
my mind. So have you looked about how those types of relationships compare?
No, but that's, I think, a fascinating question because that kind of gets back to the question of how do you figure out who is actually committed?
Because
mm-hmm. the people who use that loyalty card all the time might be doing it just because of the price discount and
mm-hmm.
because of the rewards, or they might be doing it because they actually love you. And so if you could differentiate between those people.
Seems to me if they actually love you, then they don't need a card.
They don't need it.
They don't need the discount program.
Or they want different rewards.
Okay.
So they want, instead of the monetary discount or the points or the whatever, the free coffee maker, mm-hmm. they want something that recognizes the relationship right. or that somehow takes it to the next level or allows them to express their appreciation or that lets the brand express their appreciation to the customer for. Mm-hmm. So then you would get into more kind of intangibles,
right?
Which is somewhere, but like I think some airlines kind of do that or some high-end hotel reward programs are more like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the better you can get at figuring out on an individual level kind of who's who, and the better you can reward them, the more successful you're going to be. So there's a case a few years ago, I think it's Harrah's, that looks at how good their loyalty reward program is. And they're not looking at it from kind of a committed, uncommitted relationship perspective, but just at the individual level, mm-hmm. they had enough data on their Harrah's swipe
right.
cards
yeah.
That they could figure that they would offer people different rewards mm-hmm. and see how they responded. And so they got to the point where they knew that you were motivated to come and stay with them if they offered you a free steak dinner, and that I would be motivated to come and stay with them if they offered me $50 in slot machine credits.
Mm-hmm.
And to get to that point where you understand individual consumers well enough that mm-hmm. you can say, here's what you want and here's yeah. what you want. Now, at the end of the day, if people found out, I don't know how they'd respond. I mean, I think if you offer enough value, then...
If people found out what?
That this is how specific they were getting, and okay. that they were testing people, right? Which I think is the mm-hmm. part that would be less palatable for most consumers. But I think also if you're upfront about it, mm-hmm. you say, look, and I think this is something that companies are doing a terrible job at. We have more and more and more data mm-hmm. that we could do this specific kind of analysis with if mm-hmm. we can find people who have the math skills.
Yes.
which is a whole other question.
Yeah.
But I think if you're open with consumers and you say, look, we have all this data mm-hmm. and we're collecting it, is that okay with you? And is it okay if we take that data and then make you particular offers? So if right. we understand that you really love Banana Republic jackets, can we make you special offers?
Right.
And if consumers say, okay,
mm-hmm.
then you're totally fine.
Yeah.
But if you don't ask, and if you've never gotten that permission,
right.
then you're just setting yourself up for a relationship violation in the future.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about Google, for instance, where it disturbs me that they know as much about me as they do.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, like everybody, I do a lot of it because I like the free services they're offering me.
Yeah.
But also, I haven't turned on the cookie blockers and stuff because if I'm going to see ads anyway, I'd rather see stuff that is relevant to yeah. me than that yeah. isn't. So, you know, a few years ago, I broke my foot and, well, actually, it was hilarious. While I was Googling about trying to determine if it was broken or strained, I saw an ad that was clearly targeted by what I was searching for this little device where you strap it onto your leg. You basically have a peg leg. So instead of crutches, this thing gives you essentially an artificial leg. It's awesome if you ever break
cool.
your leg. It's fantastic. But it was so relevant. And then when it was clear that the leg was broken and I was going to be on crutches for weeks,
mm-hmm.
I thought, hang on, I saw that
I'm
thing.
I'm going to go get it.
Exactly. Whereas it, you know, had it not been so directly relevant,
yep.
it would have been a wasted ad.
Yep. No, but, that's, yeah. yeah. And I think consumers, as long as you're upfront about it, I think most consumers recognize that there's value in that and mm-hmm. they're going to be okay with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to do, we need more research into things like really targeted ads, because there is also, I can't remember what it's called, the little targeted ads that have the little blue triangle
mm-hmm.
that you can click on and
yeah.
then tell people what your preferences are. Like, I would like yeah. to see more ads like this or not.
Yeah.
Most consumers, I think, don't even know that's there.
Right.
But if you told them about it, then many of them, I think, would opt in. Mm-hmm. And I think once you get that initial opt-in, mm-hmm. then you're on much more solid ground in terms of offering value and building a relationship that's based on that initial disclosure
mm-hmm.
instead of, we're not telling you, here's, like, the perfect carrot for you.
Yeah.
And when you find out how we figured out that was the perfect carrot, you're not going to be happy with us.
Right. Well, I think there's also a frustration, too, because, sorry, we should probably wrap up.
Okay.
I'm not watching the time. There's also a frustration because so often they'll say, check this box, can we send you offers? Well, no, But if you're saying clearly, we're going to spend some time getting to know what your personal preferences are.
Yeah.
And then we will send you only really relevant offers.
And only every once in a while.
Right. Then I would be much more willing to accept that.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it does come back to what you were saying. We've got a shortage of people with the math skills and the understanding of the technology to truly target.
Yeah. Because I think there's absolutely enough data to do that.
Yeah.
And I hope in the long run, and I don't think it's that far away, that that's what marketing is going to turn into. Mm-hmm. This kind of very permission-based, one-on-one, I tell you, the company, exactly what I want to see and hear and exactly what I'm interested in, and I give you permission to learn that from my behavior.
Right.
And then you give me everything back that you learn from that. You give me special offers that I'm interested in. You don't email me about shoes because I don't care about your shoes. I buy shoes from someone else. And then everybody's happy.
So why do you think they're so reluctant? Marketers are so reluctant to say that right now, to tell people what they want to do. Is it because they themselves don't know what they want to do with it?
Maybe partly. And I think a lot of it is that there's still, I mean, I think part of it is that it's changed so fast, right? Mm-hmm. This kind of data avalanche has happened before anyone really knew what to do with it or knew that it was coming. And so I think we're all kind of playing catch up, marketers and consumers alike. And a lot of it, I think, is because many marketers, and this surprises me consistently, how many businesses, even though they have all this data, because they don't have the skills or the time or the money to mine the data, they still make all these decisions based on experience or their gut. Like, this is the price we should charge for whatever it happens to be because I've been in the business for 20 years and I know.
Right.
Yeah. But you have data that you could actually figure out the answer to that question. And so, I think that's probably a lot of it. It's only the giant companies like Pepsi and et cetera, who are big enough to do all that stuff with their data. And some of that trickles down to grocery stores and other things. Like Pepsi says, put this here and that there and don't tell this.
Yeah.
But in the majority of cases, we just don't have that time or money or expertise yet.
Yeah. Is there anything that I should have asked you and I haven't?
I don't think so. We covered a lot of ground.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
It's amazing how well the analogy between human relationships and our relationships with brands actually works. Early in the interview, Sarah said that her findings differed from human relationships in that in a committed human relationship, like a marriage, she said that if your spouse tells you what to do, you'll likely do it. Personally, I'm not so sure about that. Frankly, I'd get pretty pissed off if my spouse tried to order me around. As with committed brand relationships, there's a difference between asking nicely, politely, and commanding. I did not promise to obey when we got married. Actually, my husband, who's a gourmet chef, said that our vows should have been to lust, humor, and overfeed. And the 35 pounds I've put on since we met 27 years ago suggests that he took that seriously. If you're in Edmonton, hope to see you on November 1st at Disrupt HR and or on November 22nd at FMI's Disruptive Writing. And in the meantime, I'd love it if you'd reach out to me with your thoughts on this episode and ideas for other people or topics you'd like me to cover in future ones. As always, you can reach me by email, Tema, T-E-M as in marketing A, at frankreactions.com, on Twitter, simply at Tema Frank, on the Facebook Frank Reactions page, or via LinkedIn. Have a wonderful couple of weeks. Bye.